Hi, and welcome to the second in-studio roundtable discussion around Beyond Stop Harper. Beyond Stop Harper was an online conversation that started by the Media Co-op, a coast-to-coast network of independent journalists and Media Co-op. In studio, there is my co-host with me, Stefan Christophe. Hi, Stefan.
Hey.
And we are joined in studio by two guests, Mustafa. Hi.
Hello.
Mustafa has been working a lot on migrant justice in the past few years, and we're also joined by Drew.
Hello.
Drew is the founder of the Media Co-op Network, as well as an activist for the past few years, working a lot on indigenous solidarity and the work of NGOs in the rest of the world. So we will start by a very large question that I'm going to throw at you. What is austerity? There is consensus in grassroots communities as to the problem of austerity, and there is consensus on the fact that we usually define it as an assault and some sort of political violence. However, we have trouble reaching out to either the institutional left or other people that are not necessarily as politicized. So how would you define austerity, maybe in the way it operates or how it manifests to different people? How do you understand it?
I think there's a particular dimension when thinking about the Canadian context of austerity in terms of, you know, what's taking place, let's say, in Europe, particularly in the periphery, Greece, Spain, Portugal. There's a very clear idea that austerity is a very broad-based thing that the institutional left has to deal with, that people on a daily, day-to-day living basis actually have to deal with. But in the Canadian context, it's sort of seen as just kind of that we didn't go through the same assaults that actually took place in Europe, but actually on a policy level, we did. And the Canadian state is actually just a very different sort of beast than that within Europe. So, for example, in Greece, everything is sort of under the national state: education, welfare, social assistance, housing. In the Canadian context, the federal government actually downloaded a lot of those services onto the provinces. So, austerity, if you actually take the sum of all of the policy changes that existed after the financial crisis of 2008, on a policy level, it is just as severe. But the one fundamental underlying moment that didn't happen in the Canadian context is actually that you didn't have this idea or this need to sort of to rein in, or the Canadian state to use this sort of logic, oh, that we have to rein in debt, essentially, that somehow that the public will have to pay for the private sector's debt on wholesale. But I mean, you do actually have that in a variety of forms taking place in the Canadian context.
Yeah, just to add to that a little bit, I think in terms of lived experience, when we talk about austerity, we don't talk about austerity. We talk about things like labor flexibility. We talk about balancing the budget. We talk about economic restructuring, economic stimulus, things like this are the sort of code words that the corporate media uses to talk about what are actually austerity plans, because the context that you don't see, and it's very cleverly hidden, is that, you know, before we had to balance the budget was, the revenues were cut and things were arranged such that there was a crisis. I think basically what austerity amounts to is you know, the fact that on the level of lived experiences is you try to find a job out of university and actually you can only get an unpaid internship. I think another way that it manifests is, you know, you had a public sector job, and that maybe a couple decades ago would have been considered sort of a stable living for life. And now, you know, you find yourself, you don't know whether you're going to have a job for the next year or two. I think the problem is there's sort of a boiled frog syndrome that sort of happened where we have had an austerity agenda for the last, since Mulroney, really. So it's been a couple decades of constant cuts to healthcare, constant cuts to Canada Post, constant cuts to all the different social services and the public sector, and lowering of corporate taxes, which creates a budget deficit every time we try to, increase any kind of support to public services. So basically what it all amounts to, though, is a massive transfer of wealth and economic power from the working majority, the poor majority, to a tiny economic elite, an investor class that is sort of tightening the reins on the whole Canadian situation and increasing its control, increasing its power, increasing its wealth at everyone else's expense.
When we listen to the mainstream media discussing the economic situation in Canada or austerity more broadly, often we hear rhetoric, discussion around individual responsibility, workers, the society in general, as having to address austerity in their individual lives. I just was wondering if you could address the problematics of this framing of the economic crisis as a situation that people need to respond to individually, pulling up their bootstraps, you know, organizing their lives in a different way. Why is austerity, why is this a collective problem? And also, are there collective solutions?
I mean, it's very much a collective problem. I mean, this exists because of sometimes when people discuss sort of the ideas of the free market, that this is actually a very just a well-planned economy, and that actually it is not an individual's fault when they actually go through all the hoops, and that the only job that they can find is, let's say, through a temp placement agency where they actually wake up the next day and they don't know if they have work. That is not an individual fault. It is actually the way the economy is structured that forces people to actually live in such a manner. The fact that welfare rates are 3 times lower than the minimum wage, and that the minimum wage is actually below the poverty line, is not an individual's fault. It's the way the economy is actually structured in this economy. The kind of immigration system that we have, forcing hundreds of thousands of people to come here on a temporary basis, is not an individual issue. It is a well-structured economic plan. And if one actually wants to look at the collective catastrophe that's created, I don't people look to the Canadian state as being, well, you know, you just have to look to Alberta in terms of Harper's vision of Canada. I actually think it's accurate, but I think the most accurate circumstance to watch a collective catastrophe is the East Coast. That's actually the vision of Harper's Canada and for the economic elite of this country. Force thousands upon thousands of people out of work, force them to migrate to Alberta, bring in thousands upon thousands of people from North Africa to replace them at service jobs without any contracts, without any work safety, without any work security, and then at the same time to ensure that profits remain high for a select few group of people, displace Indigenous people from their land. That is the incubator of the structure of this economy, and that to me is the way austerity is being driven. So, and I think the problem, sort of this individual rhetoric and why it functions, is that we actually don't have any alternatives on the table. And I think that's why also the difference between the institutional left here and, let's say, somewhere like in Europe, is that actually it's because the left has been able to push that analysis in Europe, and yet here we haven't been able to create the capacity to push a collective response to challenge that idea that it is individual fault, and that it is a result of sort of individuals not being able to play the game well. And I mean, even if you look at the circumstance of debt and high levels of personal debt and the rhetoric that comes from Stephen Harper and Jim Flaherty and whatnot, actually the best analysis came from the right-wing media, is that sort of this consumer index is one sort of one mechanism to sort of to see what is taking place, is that they said that consumer index has only gone up by 1%, so it's sort of matching inflation, yet debt has soared to astronomical levels, so much so that we are one of the highest indebted countries on earth per GDP, beyond the United States, and we only sort of we match that of the United Kingdom. And so the question is it every individual's fault, or is that actually based upon the structure of our economy?
Yeah, just to add to that, I mean, I think the boiled frog scenario comes back, and we have to kind of get out of the gradual, raising of the temperature, the gradual sort of impoverishment and deepening of the sort of divide between the rich and the poor that's happened over the last number of decades, to really get a real perspective on what this is. I mean, I think the big perspective is that we live in one of the most fabulously wealthy societies that's ever existed on this planet. And yet, when you look at the level of leisure time, when you look at the level of security, you don't see it. You don't see any kind of payoff for that. Instead, what you see is people are more and more sort of afraid of losing their what employment they have. People don't feel secure. People are saddled with huge amounts of student debt or other debt to pay for what's seen as the sort of standard of living. So I think we need to understand where this disconnect comes from. Look at the experiences of the sort of generation that entered the workforce in the 60s and 70s. The situation was pretty different. You could get a decent paying job, right out of school. You didn't have that much student debt. There were all kinds of economic opportunities available. So what's difference between then and now? Certainly not the level of wealth that's being generated by the economy. The GDP has only gone up, since the 60s and 70s. What hasn't, gone up, what's gone the opposite direction is wages. Wages have, in absolute terms, have not kept pace with inflation and have actually declined for the majority of the population since the late 60s, early 70s, when neoliberalism really started its assault. So that's been, this has been a process that's been happening. And right now we're seeing the sort of a quickening of that process. We're seeing a speeding up that's happened because there was an economic crisis in 2008 and corporate profits were flying along, very well. If you look at, the Wall Street, or the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the overall economy was profits were on the increase, everything was going great until 2008, and then profits fell, and so they have to go find more profits from somewhere, and the only place they can't do it through investing in innovation or reinvesting in the economy, because they want to hold on to what they have. So the only thing the investor class can do is go find it in the pockets of the working class and the poor.
You're still listening to the Beyond Stop Harper Roundtable. I'd like to take a moment to shift the conversation to our movements in words, essentially. A participant to the roundtable online mentioned how people at the margins of the mainstream economic debate conversation still find themselves at the margins of the same conversation within grassroots communities. So I'd like to hear your thoughts about it, perhaps talk about the cause of this or how we can address it, perhaps starting with Moose, since you've been working with on migrant justice a lot.
Well, I mean, I think, one of the things that you find is that sort of in this discussion about austerity is that even when it rarely takes place in sort of the mainstream or within the institutional left, is that the concept is that it's solely an attack on the public wage, and it's solely an attack on the public sector, that's sort of unions in the public sector. And that's the discussion. That's our idea or construct of class. When in fact, that the people on the margins actually are no longer on the margins. One thing that we've been working on at the Immigrant Workers Center is trying to build this, what we call a precarious workers coalition. So people who are undocumented workers, people who are immigrants, citizens, non-citizens, without status, with status, who work for placement agencies, who work for the largest companies in Quebec, Aldo Shoes, Dollarama, for companies where these are the richest people in Quebec, Lassonde, Oasis Juice, the list goes on and on. And temporary foreign workers, the Live-In Caregiver Program or under the Low Skilled Pilot Project. And they play the brunt of austerity. They on a global and local level, right? The fact that these are the people displaced from economic violence, from neoliberal policies that stemmed from these countries like Canada, the US, then are forced to migrate here to look for better work. And then once they arrive here, are sort of the guinea pigs in terms of an attack on the living standards of everyone. That because if you can pay someone $4 an hour, person who's getting paid maybe 16 or 18 is not really going to fight that much. And you've divided them in terms of this person stealing my job, as opposed to a sense of solidarity that, well, maybe that person should be getting paid as much as I am, or building that sense of solidarity. So it's very true on the institutional left and in our movements that there isn't this construct of solidarity. And in terms of particularly migrants and migrant justice movements being sort of incorporated in an analysis of what austerity is, but it's actually foundational to the way work has changed, to what our notions of class are. You can't separate class and race, and particularly immigration anymore. I mean, this is like the 1800s in the United States and in Canada all over again, which is, so even the model, it's the boiling, I mean, you brought up the boiling frog, but it's beyond the boiling frog. It's essentially Canada's economic model has always been take people's land, take whatever you can from that land, and actually bring in cheap labor from abroad to be able to process that and to sell that abroad. It's, so there's nothing new about what we're actually seeing. It's not even from the 70s. It's actually from the beginnings, since Sir John A. Macdonald. So we have to fight to incorporate that analysis into broader movements to build that solidarity. It's critical.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's been really amazingly encouraging, but really still has a long way to go, is seeing the mainstreaming of indigenous solidarity. So I think there's really been an understanding that just probably stemming mostly from I guess the fact that indigenous communities are much more likely to stand up against extraction industries that are, you know, devastating our ecological systems, and also the fact that they have their rights to the land are enshrined in the Canadian Constitution, makes them extremely well equipped to fight against those extraction things, or extraction projects like the tar sands. So I think we've seen on a relatively superficial level the sort of adoption of indigenous solidarity into into movements. I think everyone has to at least pay lip service to it. I think where it gets a little more challenging is that we need to understand, like Mustafa was just saying, that Canada is a fabulously wealthy country for a very specific reason, that we have huge amounts of natural resources. And when I say we, I actually mean Indigenous nations, because those are the peoples who are the caretakers of that land, and who it was stolen from in order to get access to those resources. So we need to understand our whole economy comes from this extraction-based this extraction, which is based on land theft, and that that's not some kind of matter of ancient history that's been sort of I think the response kind of tends to be to sweep it under the historical carpet and say, oh, okay, well, that happened decades ago, or that happened 100 years ago, we can't really change that. But that's not true. The land theft is an ongoing process, and actually the majority of the territory of Canada is still Indigenous land, and just by the most basic definition, which is the majority of people who live there are Indigenous people. So I think that needs to be understood when we look at the land, the map of Canada, the land mass. Actually, the majority of that is not a place where white or settlers even are the majority, which is I think changes your perspective on where things need to go. So I think in terms of what movements need to do, acknowledging that history first and foremost, but also standing in solidarity with the front lines of how that history is moving forward, in terms of there being just a constant assault in terms of enforced poverty, in terms of gender-based violence, and you know, that's enforced by, that's basically perpetuated by the Canadian state in terms of the missing and murdered Indigenous women and the kind of ongoing refusal of police to do anything about that, mm-hmm. the ongoing refusal of the government to make any kind of inquiries, and instead use it as a pretext to crack down further on Indigenous people. You have, you know, the fact that people on reserve have about half the per student funding of you know, any other you know, grade school students in Canada, which is just preposterous. It's just a ridiculous state of affairs. But it's there for a reason. It's there because there's an ongoing program of land theft that needs to be perpetuated, and any amount of leeway and power that the government you know, gives to those communities, it knows that that's going to strengthen them in their fight to maintain their ties to the land, maintain that ecology. So I think we need to. I think that that just as much as migration is going to be extremely important, it's going to be actually central because we're going to have millions of climate refugees in the next couple decades that are going to be flooding, you know, the industrialized countries all over the world. And I think we need to understand, movements really need to get their act together in terms of, like, how do we transform our society so that when those millions of people start to come in, it's not a question of, you know, there's so little, we need to divide ourselves from those newcomers and look at it from a position of scarcity, but we actually need to figure out how we can come at this from a spirit of justice, in the sense that, you know, were a big part of the problem that caused those people to come here or forced those people to come here. And second of all, to understand it from a position of abundance in terms of, you know, we're going to have to figure out a way that we can all live together in a way that's not divisive, that doesn't let elites play us off against each other and turn it into a sort of a, you know, vaguely fascist sort of divide and conquer strategy.
We've addressed so many topics here on this discussion. We don't have that much more time, but I had one final question, which was, you mentioned the assault on public institutions today. We see that happening with post-secondary education. We see that happening with the public healthcare system. We see that happening with institutional programs that were benefiting people, whether it's old age security or employment insurance. And the thing that is common to all those institutions was that those were won through social movements on the streets, whether it was workers' unions, whether it was organizing of students to fight for accessible education. Those major institutions that are being dismantled today were won through the organizing of people. And I think that's often left out of the mainstream media depiction of what's happening. Those movements largely happened after that first wave of economics that defined Canada, that you were talking about, Moose, the origins of Canada as a land of you know, taking resources from Indigenous people and bringing in workers from abroad. We're seeing sort of a return to that, as you were talking about. But I'm wondering if you could talk about organizing and recognizing that these institutions that are being dismantled come from popular movements, not sort of a liberal notion of the state sort of passing on its wealth to the people. So where are we at today? What do you think we can do about all these issues that you've highlighted, given there is that history?
I mean, for me, I think it for any movement that's even going to sort of take on these sort of immediate issues, I think we need to sort of look beyond. You know, I think a lot of the left for a long time sort of looked towards unions as sort of being this, okay, these mass institutions that will sort of be this bridgehead against these public sector attacks. I don't think that's, you know, I mean, there will be moments where push comes to shove and then they will do that organizing. But I think for us, I think we really have to recognize it's a daunting moment, but it's also a very much an opportunity. That the majority of people, the majority of poor people, the majority of working people are no longer in these mass institutions, at least not in sort of English Canada. maybe in Quebec there's a different rate, but even then, because this idea of that, and this goes back to the question that Arish posed earlier, which is that there's sort of this idea of that working people are sort of white, 45, and balding, that's no longer the case. And so a lot of these communities are not actually organized. And it's not that those issues aren't relevant. I mean, if we look at, you know, ask ourselves this table around the room, do you want to work till you're 67, or would you rather stay, or would you rather retire when you're 65? And especially if you're making minimum wage, your body's going to be much, much sore by the time that you get to that point. And also, do you want that old age security to be at a you know, practically a non-living wage? So to get back to it, I think the majority of people are not part of these movements. And I think we have a sort of an obligation, an opportunity to do that work. And I think if we can build those alliances between immigrants, migrant workers, indigenous people, and I think also people in those institutions, in the public sector institutions, and fight on all of those fronts, then I think we can stop those immediate attacks. And I think there's people are sort of scared, and not scared, but hesitant to sort of say, why should I fight for someone who's being paid $23 an hour when I'm getting paid minimum wage and I don't even know if I'm going to go to work the next day? And I think that's an important question that we have to address. And we come up with the rhetoric, well, you know, it's in all of our benefit, but how come it's not the other way around? How come the person that's getting paid $23 an hour is answering the question, what am I doing to show solidarity with the person who's getting paid minimum wage or doesn't have a job? And so I think we can facilitate that two-way street. And I think that's sort of the job for us in the coming sort of, you know, in the immediate and in the long term, to actually to create a real challenge.
Yeah, I think there's just a really quick, there's an interesting anecdote from history, which is that R.B. Bennett, who was the sort of contemporary Stephen Harper during the Depression in the 30s, you know, actually swore that he would never pay anyone, you know, when people were demanding unemployment insurance, he swore that he would never pay anyone to be idle, were his words. And movements pretty quickly switched that around. You know, among other things, there was, you know, 1,000 anarchists that got on hop trains and started making their way to Ottawa and started brawling with the RCMP in Regina and you know, within a year of that kind of thing happening, you know, the On to Ottawa March and other mobilizations, there was, you know, they implemented unemployment insurance. So I think that Harper, you know, it's a function of our popular power whether we get those things. Just to add one more thing is that I think we've let the state, we've had the state be the arbiter of our social movements, you know, and our demands for a long time. And I think we need to start to think about how we can make demands that build popular power and don't give the state the sort of, don't entrust the state with our well-being.
Thank you, Drew. Thank you, Mustafa. That will be the end of our panel discussion. You can keep following what's going on the Beyond Stump Harper discussion online on the Media Co-op site, and that will be it for us.